Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with another anthology of horror episode. I think we're into the Halloween hangover part of the year. Is that right? This is actually going to be airing in November now.
That's right. We're recording this the week of Halloween. We wanted to keep recording Halloween content the week of Halloween, which means Halloween lasts an extra week in our publication schedule. This is indeed going to be Anthology of Horror Volume 6, or we might say it's Volume 666, because we're going to be considering some infernal subject matter in this one.
Do you know that due to textual variance in the ancient manuscripts of the New Testament, there is some debate about whether the original number was 666 or 616? They apparently both work as a cipher for the name of Caesar Nero.
Well, it's interesting, but you got to admit, 616, not nearly as sinister. It doesn't have the cinematic qualities. You know, it doesn't have all that. It's not backed up by our B cinema and our horror fiction.
Though it does look a little bit ominous with the two sixes kind of closing in on the one. I don't know. I could see it working, but I think you're right. The three sixes work better.
Now, if you're not familiar with the anthology of horror episodes that we put out around Halloween, this is basically what the gimmick consists of. We each pick some particular episodes from either sci-fi horror TV anthology shows or anthology films. You know, this is stuff like on TV, Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, Black Mirror, etc. And then in the cinematic tradition, it's stuff like Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, or Stephen King's Cat's Eye, that sort of thing. Movies that contain generally like three or more mini segments, each one a self-contained story with some sort of narrative structure holding it all together.
Did we actually do Stephen King's Cat's Eye in a previous year?
I don't think we did. I was tempted to this year because they have that Quitter's Ink episode,
you know, where
James Woods learns to quit smoking by having his family tormented by maniacs.
Right. It's like a smoking cessation clinic run by the mob, and they terrorize you. But like anything that James Woods is in, James Woods is the scariest part.
Yeah. It's a... I'm not sure how that film really holds up. When I think back on that film, I mainly remember the bit with the little girl and the little troll.
Mm-hmm.
And the giant bedroom set they had to construct to make it possible. Because one of the cool things is I got to meet a guy who worked on that production.
And
he had some photos from the set of this giant bed. Because once they built it, they had to build a giant bed so they could have somebody in that troll suit walk around on it. And so there were pictures of the cast members on the bed, you know, posing with it. So it was a lot of fun. I think it is the most fun aspect of that particular film. Certainly the most memorable.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, the basic premise is that there's like a Ken doll sized troll that comes out of the wall at night and is attempting to suck a little girl's life spirit out, but her cat must protect her. And so the cat is actually the hero of the story, maybe much like one of the films we're going to be talking about a little bit later.
Yeah, definitely. Cat's Eye does tie into something we're going to discuss here in a little bit. But before we get to the infernal world of cats, we're going to have to consider the infernal world of demonic bargains. So, Joe, set up your selection for Anthology of Horror Volume 6.
Okay, I think I've established a precedent, at least in one of the previous years, maybe in both, that I've always got to talk about a Treehouse of Horror, because I love The Simpsons. The Treehouse of Horror episodes are maybe my favorites of all time, and today I'm going to be talking about The Devil and Homer Simpson. This is one of the all-time great Treehouse of Horror segments. It is, I think, from season 4, from Treehouse of Horror 3.
This always throws me off anytime I'm trying to keep my treehouses straight, because each one has a different number that's one off from the season year.
Mm-hmm.
So I lose track if I'm looking for 4. Am I talking about season 4? Am I talking about Treehouse 4?
Yeah, it's like centuries, right? How like the first century does not start with the number 1. The second century starts with the number 1. Yeah.
It's easier to just start watching Treehouse of Horror episodes and just stop when you can't really take it anymore.
Yeah. So the premise of The Devil and Homer Simpson is that Homer Simpson is trapped at work in his boring job at the nuclear power plant. I think he's supposed to be the safety inspector. And he is fiercely covetous of a snack. He really wants a donut, but Lenny and Carl ate all the other donuts, or somebody ate them. And then Homer goes looking for his emergency backup donut, opens up like a book that he's cut out the inside of. I think it's the operation manual for his nuclear safety equipment. And he finds that, in fact, the donut that's supposed to be in there is missing. And instead, there's a note that says, like, "Dear Homer, I owe you one donut." And he's, you know, like, "Oh, damn it. He's always one step ahead of me."
Mm-hmm.
So he announces to no one in particular that he would sell his soul for a donut. And of course, when you're talking to nobody in particular, there is somebody listening, and it's the devil. So Satan appears in the form of Ned Flanders with goat legs and a pitchfork and a cool red jacket, and he makes a deal with Homer. The devil will supply Homer with a donut, and Homer will render his soul. Now, briefly, Homer believes that he's outsmarted the devil because he realizes he can eat all but the last bite of the donut and still keep his soul. But then, unfortunately, sometime later, Homer is maybe sort of sleepwalking, or at least is hungry for a midnight snack, and he disregards the notes all over the leftover donut bite in the fridge that say things like "Dad's soul donut, do not eat," and he eats it. And then when he does, Flanders appears to claim his prize, but then Marge intervenes, and she says, you know, Homer should receive a fair trial. So in the meantime, Homer gets sent to hell for a day where the demons attempt to ironically torture him by force-feeding him thousands of donuts, but Homer doesn't really seem to be bothered by this. And in the end, Homer wins the trial, Merchant of Venice style, on a technicality when Marge cleverly proves that he had in fact already handed over possession of his soul to somebody else, to her. So the soul was not really his to sell in the first place, so it was a no-go deal to begin with. But then in the end, the devil gets his revenge, and he turns Homer's head into a giant donut, which Homer will, of course, forever be picking at and snacking on.
Yeah, you get the idea that he's still pretty doomed, because it's like the next day or something, you know, and he's already picking at his donut head.
Uh-huh. Yes, it's the same kind of bad thinking that led them to keep the original piece of Homer's soul donut in the fridge instead of just like throwing it out or destroying it or something.
Right. Yeah, this is a wonderful episode. One of these episodes I've watched more times than I can remember. I watched it this year, in fact, as we introduced our son to the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episodes. One of my favorite parts of this is that when we get to the actual trial, of course, Lionel Hutz briefly serves as the Simpsons defense attorney during the proceedings before, I believe, he runs away. Like the great thing about Lionel Hutz is that he always has like enormous overconfidence that he can do these things, but is so incapable of performing. But then he in this episode he realizes it, asks to go to the bathroom, and like escapes through the window.
He's the quintessential American character, just endless confidence, no competence, and in the end runs away.
Right.
There's also a great moment where he's just combing his hair with a fork as he walks into frame.
Yeah.
So obviously, this is a great opportunity to talk about deals with the devil, because I think deals with the devil are interesting in multiple domains, one from a sort of history of religions point of view and another from a psychological point of view. And one of the things I'd like to start by talking about is that while the contract with the devil, the deal with Satan, may seem like a perversion of the religious impulse, I would argue that actually the more personalized and asymmetrical relationship between God and the believer in the modern Abrahamic religions is really the qualitative outlier from a historical perspective. For a huge amount of religion throughout all of history, the relationship between the believer and the gods has been seen as significantly more practical and contractual. You know, from this God, I want this particular blessing or favor, and in return, I offer this ritual or this sacrifice. So, for example, in ancient Roman religion, there is actually a term for this. It's do ut des, meaning I give that you might give back. So I will sacrifice a goat at your shrine, or I will do whatever ritual, I will burn incense for you, and in return, you will give me a good harvest, or you will heal my sick child, etc.
Yeah, and this also, like, it's an easy parallel to, say, pledging your loyalty to some sort of tribal lord.
Exactly. I mean, this is one of the ways in which the farther you go back in religion, the more religious relationships seem to mirror political, practical types of relationships than a lot of the big religions do today. So in a way, the deal with the devil, I would say, is not a myth archetype that needed to be invented out of whole cloth by Christian storytellers. Instead, it just took an extremely ancient, extremely common way of practicing religion and put a nefarious, infernal gloss on it. Like, the part that remains unchanged is that there's a devotee and they ask for some kind of supernatural deliverance or aid. But now, instead of sacrificing a cow to Minerva to get what you want, you have to pay some kind of ultimate price, some unreasonable price, like your eternal soul or your child or something. And you pay it not to some god of a particular domain, but to the anti-god, the figure of evil incarnate. So clearly the Simpsons segment here is drawing on the Christian tradition of the deal with the devil, but I would say that that is not an archetype that originates with Christianity. It's more a sort of reimagining of traditional religion with a very negative spin on it.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reeks, too, of applying a satanic paint job to pre-Christian religious traditions as well.
Exactly. But since this episode is dealing with the Christian tradition of the deal with the devil, I also want to look at the history of how that idea developed. So in the Christian tradition, the oldest story of an attempted deal with the devil that I'm aware of actually takes place in the Bible. It's in the Gospels in the New Testament. So after Jesus' baptism, he goes out into the wilderness to fast for 40 days and 40 nights. And during that time, the devil appears to him and offers him temptations. And the temptations culminate in this passage in the Gospel of Matthew that goes as follows. This is in chapter 4, verses 8 to 9. Quote, "Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me.'" Now, of course, Jesus refuses this temptation. He says, "Well, I'm only going to worship the Lord as commanded in the scripture." But the suggestion of the architecture is there. If he had taken the devil up on his bargain, he would have surrendered something extremely important. It's not made clear exactly what that is, but he would have sort of like surrendered righteousness or surrendered godhood or something like that. And in return, he would be granted, you know, this great earthly power.
Yeah, I guess the way I've often seen it presented, what is like, you know, Jesus is on this mission to save the world. And the devil says, hey, but what if you didn't save the world? What if I set you up all nice and fancy here? And then you could just kind of like rule the world. That'd be pretty good too, right? Why don't we do that? Then everybody's happy.
Yes. And so there might be a question like, wait a minute, why would the devil be offering the world to Jesus? Like, wouldn't Jesus have more domain over the world anyway?
But he's the ruler of the kingdom of the air, though.
That's right. Yes, this gets into some interesting stuff about apocalypticism that I want to talk about in just a minute. So to follow more about the Christian tradition of the deal with the devil, I was looking at an entry in the Dictionary of Biblical Tradition and English Literature, edited by David Lyle Jeffrey. And there's a good entry on the tradition of pacts with the devil by Camille R. Labossiere. So regarding the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness, Labossiere points out that the primary appeals in this story are to pride, which is kind of interesting. Like in one of the temptations, Satan asks Jesus to bow down and worship him, but in the others, he simply prompts Jesus to make a vulgar display of his own power. He says, okay, you've been fasting for 40 days. If you're so hungry, why don't you turn these stones into bread? And there's a very interesting passage in the Gospel of Mark that ties into the idea of deals with the devil as well. Now, the Gospel of Mark is the earliest of the four Gospels in the New Testament. It probably represents the earliest stages of a lot of these stories about Jesus's life. And in this story, Jesus has been performing miracles. He's healing the sick. He's exorcising demons. He gathers the 12 disciples to follow him. And then in chapter 3, verse 22, he gets a challenge from the religious scholars. The religious scholars come up to him, and it says they came down from Jerusalem, and they said, quote, "He hath Beelzebub, and by the prince of devils casteth he out devils." So they're saying, look, I know how he's casting out devils. He's made a deal with like the head demon, the chief devil, and he's using that demon power to cast out these devils so he can win over you peasants here. And this is interesting because so earlier this year, I had the biblical historian Bart Ehrman on the podcast to talk about where the Christian concepts of heaven and hell came from and how they developed over time. And if you haven't checked that episode out, I recommend it. I thought Bart was a really fantastic guest. But one of the historical trends that he talks about in a lot of his work, and he discusses in that episode as well, is the development of what's known as apocalyptic theology in Judaism in the centuries leading up to the birth of Christianity. And it's a little bit complicated, but I'll try to do the brief, simplified version. And it goes like this. For many centuries, the Jewish prophetic tradition had attributed misfortunes of the Jewish people to punishment for their sins. So it would be like, oh, you were conquered by the Babylonians and your crops were eaten by the locust. That is because God is punishing you for your wickedness. But eventually over time, sort of the manifest unfairness of this theology became untenable for many Jews. Like, how does it make sense that my 3-year-old child is being punished for the sins of our king? And so a new theology arose within the Jewish religion to explain suffering, and that was that suffering was not punishment for sins, but it was the result of the faithful children of Israel being persecuted and victimized by forces of darkness. The idea is that there are evil rulers and evil powers who have made deals with the devil, who have gone into cooperation with a powerful evil being who is opposed to God, and this is the devil. And God will eventually destroy the devil and destroy these evil rulers who are in league with him and will right all wrongs. But until then, we're stuck under the boot of these wicked temporal powers who are allied with and empowered by Satan.
It's essentially kind of a dystopian a template for religion.
Yes, very much so, but with the idea that eventually everything would be fixed, that ultimately God is sovereign, ultimately good will win over evil, but now we're stuck in this bad middle period where we're suffering under the arrangements made with the evil forces.
It's the Matrix.
Kind of, yes. Though it would develop into even more Matrix-y directions with the advent of Gnosticism. which is one of the most fun things. If you actually go back and watch The Matrix after learning about Gnostic theology, there are huge overlaps there that are very fun to mess around with.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I'm not sure when will be the right time, but I'm looking forward to rewatching all of those films because it's been a long time, and I know they got The Matrix 4 in the works. So,
what, really?
Yeah.
I feel more excited about that than I should be.
No, I mean, there's a lot of room to explore. I'm interested to see what they put together.
But anyway, to come back to these ancient theological developments, another thing that I think is interesting about the development of apocalyptic theology is the idea of wicked people being empowered by a pact with Satan or demons. That could sort of be viewed as a logical inversion of the belief that the Jewish people were protected by what they called a covenant with the God of Israel. A covenant is essentially a contract that they would worship him exclusively, scorning all other gods, and he would protect them as a people. But anyway, given the popularity of this type of apocalyptic thinking around the first century CE, I think it makes sense that the author of the gospel might have a story like this here, where Jesus's enemies who don't understand him would accuse him of somehow being empowered through a pact with demonic forces. Like maybe they, in the author's view here, misunderstand Jesus as one of these evil princes, one of these evil powers who has been allied against the good people.
It's almost like they're accusing him of selling out.
Yes, exactly. And Labassiere points out that many early Christian church fathers, such as Justin Martyr and Origen, they allege that people who possess powers like divination, so the power to acquire otherwise hidden knowledge or to predict the future, that people who have these powers acquire them through arrangements with the devil. Especially influential in this respect is the writing of St. Augustine. In his theological work on Christian doctrine, he claimed that people who have apparent magical powers, such as divination or prognostication, they gain these powers through consultations, pacts, and contracts with demons. And there's a passage in St. Augustine that's quoted as an authority on this subject all through the Middle Ages and is repeated in canon law in the Catholic Church. But in the Middle Ages, it's when the stories about these kinds of pacts get more developed. So the Middle Ages saw a proliferation of folk tales about pacts with the devil, especially concerning deals between the devil and a powerful or learned man. So one example is the story of St. Cyprian, who Labassiere says is a, quote, magus philosophus, or, you know, like a magician philosopher, a man of great arcane learning, quote, who strikes a bargain with the devil to learn the secrets of the universe. But he gets turned around. He responds to the appeals of a virtuous woman named Justina or Juliana, and he repents of his wicked pact. So he gets out of it. And even more well-known in the Middle Ages is the story of Theophilus of Adana, and I thought this was a lot of fun. So Theophilus was a cleric who is said to have lived in the 6th century in Asia Minor. This would be in Cilicia in modern-day Turkey, so that's like the southern part of modern-day Turkey. And the story goes that Theophilus is an archdeacon of Adana. He's a high-up guy in the church, but he's a very humble and righteous man. And he is elected to become a new bishop in Adana, but out of humility, he turns down the position. He's like, oh, no, I am not worthy. So a different guy gets elected bishop instead, but then, in a cruel twist of fate, the new bishop is swayed by some false rumors about Theophilus's character, and he kicks Theophilus out of his archdeaconship, and Theophilus is mad. He does not like this, so he's like, I've been wronged, I've got to get revenge. And in a quest for revenge, he seeks out the aid of a sorcerer, sometimes described as a necromancer, and this guy helps Theophilus write out a contract with the devil in his own blood. The devil will give Theophilus the bishopric of Adana, and in return, Theophilus will renounce Christ, renounce the Virgin Mary, and hand over his soul to Satan. And the deal goes through, and he becomes the bishop. The devil delivers his half of the bargain. But then Theophilus gets cold feet. It's like, oh no, I really screwed up. So he gets scared he's going to go to hell, and he ends up fasting for a couple of periods, like a total of 70 days. He prays to the Virgin Mary to get him out of the contract, And at first she appears to him and just really chews him out. She's like, you have been an extremely naughty bishop. That was very bad of you to do. But eventually she relents and she grants him absolution. So you'd think everything's solved now, but the devil does not give up. The next morning, Theophilus wakes up with the contract that he had written in his blood lying on his chest. And I guess that's a sign that the devil is still trying to hold him to account. So next, what Theophilus does is, inspired by the Virgin Mary, he takes the contract to the bishop who had originally removed him from the archdeaconship, and he confesses everything. And the bishop then burns the contract, which frees Theophilus' soul from this infernal bargain, and Theophilus is so relieved to have his soul back that he dies of joy on the spot. And I think this story brings up a couple features that will appear again and again in stories about deals with the devil. I think it's very interesting that you see these features repeated so often. One is that you can get out of a deal with the devil. You make the deal, you get what you want, but then upon repenting, you can sort of void the contract, so to speak. And then the second feature that appears again and again is that you can get out of it with the intercession or intervention of a virtuous woman.
What I love about this is that, you know, though fantastic and supernatural in its elements, it's basically a critique of short-term versus long-term thinking, you know?
Yes.
Because it's often about, like, somebody, like, in this case, I want revenge now. I'm not going to think about what happens later with my eternal soul, but also just, like, my life past the point of getting my vengeance. And likewise with Homer. Like, he's not thinking about the long term. He's thinking about that immediate reward. He's failing the ultimate marshmallow test, you know?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about those exact themes. It's the prioritization of the temporal, and in a way, there's this idea that people make decisions without thinking them through. They make the decision on the basis of their appetites or their lusts or their emotions. And then once they have time to think about it, they repent of the decision they have made. And often, weirdly enough, I mean, this doesn't happen in every case. Like, we'll get to Dr. Faustus in a bit. And in Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, he does not get out of the deal. He just gets claimed by the devil. But in a lot of these deals, eventually, once you think it through and you say, oh, no, I really screwed up, somebody good, usually a virtuous and clever woman, will intervene on your behalf and you'll get out of it.
I mean, to a certain extent, we see that in Dante's Inferno, right? I mean, Beatrice is kind of this guiding light that is there to sort of pull, like a tractor beam, to pull Dante up through Inferno and Purgatory up towards Paradise.
It's very interesting that in a lot of these stories, the character who makes the deal with the devil is tempted by pride. And in the Divine Comedy, it's made explicit that Dante's main sin is pride. That's the sin that he really has to be absolved of when he goes through purgatory. And it's the main sin that Beatrice is helping purge him of.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite things about the Divine Comedy, actually, is all the passages where he's like, having been cleansed of the sin of pride, I will now go back to Earth, having written the greatest poem of all time, and will convince everybody that they should do, you know, that they should follow the path of righteousness because I've written the best poem ever written.
Right. I mean, he did really write a zinger there. Yeah. I mean, But yes, I don't know if you can make a strong case for the pride being completely purged from Dante.
But anyway, so from here, Labassière goes on to mention a number of other stories and pacts with the devil that were popular in the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. For example, the Anglo-Norman poem, which is apparently satirical, that takes the form of a full legal document resigning the soul of the signatory to the devil in exchange for the freedom to live in hedonic pleasure, hoarding wealth and exploiting the poor. And I got to say, as a brief, like, moralistic theological note, one thing I can sometimes appreciate, I mean, obviously there are extreme limitations to the insights of medieval moral philosophy, but one thing I appreciate going back and reading a lot of these rebukes of immorality from the Middle Ages is a thing that gets singled out again and again is abusing the poor.
Absolutely.
Now, there are more kinds of pacts with the devil in Chaucer, in the Friar's Tale, in the canon Yeoman's Tale. There's this idea that people who seek pacts with the devil are often lusting after wealth or especially secret knowledge. The ultimate secrets of alchemy seem to be a real draw for people to get into these bad deals. Like, to chase after the philosopher's stone is to make an enemy of God. And these themes really come through in the Renaissance in perhaps the most famous literary character who makes a deal with the devil, which is Dr. Faustus. We've talked about the Faust legend on the show before. This is a story with many lives, many new sets of clothes over the ages. So we won't rehash all of that here, but it is yet another tale of a person who seeks great power and knowledge and then kind of squanders it and of course seeks it through a deal with the devil and is ultimately claimed.
There's a fair amount of lust in there, too.
Yes. Labossiere also points out an interesting parallel that I might not have thought of otherwise, but it's Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice between Antonio and Shylock, and because of the anti-Semitic assumptions of the play, the Jewish moneylender Shylock is portrayed very much as a devil figure toying with Antonio's fate. And is, as is so often the case in these tales, Antonio is saved by the intercession of a virtuous woman, Portia, who wins his case by finding a technical loophole in the wording of the contract, much like Marge does in The Devil and Homer Simpson. As for the title of the Simpsons segment, it is, of course, adapted from the title of the short story by Stephen Vincent Benet, The Devil and Daniel Webster, in which a New England farmer sells his soul to the devil, then hires the famous lawyer and orator Daniel Webster to represent him in a trial to get it back. And Webster's speech to the jury of the damned souls is so eloquent that they find for the defendant, even though there's no evidence on his behalf, which is pretty good.
You know, as much as we love courtroom dramas, in especially in this country, and as much as we love, the horrifying and the satanic, why have we not? Maybe we have, and I'm not aware of it. We need a Law and Order infernal unit, or we need a Daniel Webster Law and Order mashup, where not just like one episode, but every episode. Deals with some sort of satanic bargain. I'm half joking, but I also, now that I'm thinking about it, like, I think this has legs. I think this could be a series. I'd watch it.
The Perry Mason of the afterlife.
Yeah.
What's your favorite courtroom drama? Do you have one? Are you a My Cousin Vinny guy?
I mean, no. I mean, what are some of the great? I mean, you have to go with like To Kill a Mockingbird, right?
Oh, okay.
Something like that. I'm trying to think of
going
any.
Going to the serious end.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know a lot of the stuff in between. Like, I feel like it for me to get into a courtroom drama, it needs to be really good. Or I can't think of one that's amusingly crappy. You know,
maybe A Few Good Men. Like, A Few Good Men is like entertaining but extremely hokey.
Yeah, I mean, it does have that classic moment that's been lampooned so many times. Yeah, I don't know. My favorite courtroom scenes are all from episodes of The Simpsons or Futurama.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it.
I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
You know, I was thinking there's another type of picture of a deal with the devil, which is the idea of deal with the devil as compliment, like the idea that an artist or a musician or somebody is so talented that their genius or their talent must have come from a deal with the devil, like this was said of the great Delta blues musician Robert Johnson. Mm-hmm. But of course, it was something that the romantic poets often said about themselves. The English romantic poets Blake and Shelley characterized literary genius and poetic energy as a diabolical pact.
Yeah, this is interesting, too, because I think it is reflected in a lot of celebrity worship culture today, but is perhaps a way, on one level, like a way of trying to make sense of extreme success. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of have to tell yourself, well, yeah, they're highly successful at what they do and or they're highly talented, but at what cost? And you can sort of comfort yourself by saying, I didn't pay that cost. I may not have a number one album out there, but I also didn't sell my soul to the devil. And you can feel a little better about it. And then it's also sort of, in a way, it's kind of a twisted version of instead of saying, well, you know, this celebrity, deep down, they're a person too, and they're full of insecurities like I am. You know, they're concerned about the future, et cetera. Instead of humanizing, you kind of go in a different direction and say, well, yes, but they're going to hell because they made a soul exchange with the devil. Like, I don't know, it gets very weird, very twisted up.
No, I think that's really good. I think you're exactly right. In the same way that it feels good to watch a really rich person be miserable, it at least feels good to think about somebody who has talents and successes that you're jealous of. You're like, well, they must have done something bad to get that.
Yeah, they lost something in the bargain. And I guess it does. You can certainly compare it to some of the stats about, say, lottery winners, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where there's a strong argument to say that is a deal made with the devil. You get this enormous reward, this enormous cash prize, but statistically, it brings a lot of chaos into your life.
Is that true, though? I've heard people say that, but I feel like I've looked into that before, and it turns out that might not be as true as is sometimes alleged. It certainly would make us feel better for it to be true.
Yeah, that's the thing. It needs to be true for the injustice of the universe to make sense.
Right.
But then again, with the lottery thing, for example, I mean, I think one of the great things about that is we're always, each and every one of us, you know, we're the first ones to say to ourselves, well, you know, if you win the lottery, it's going to bring a lot of chaos into your life, but I think I can handle it. You know, we always think we're the exception. It's kind of like, man,
I can quit anytime I want.
Yeah, like making a deal with the devil or picking up a monkey's paw, that's bad news. But I think I might be able to make it work. I think I could word my demand in just the right way that the devil's going to be totally cool with it.
I wouldn't eat the whole donut. I would leave that last bite and not forget about it. Yeah. Or I would know how to phrase the monkey's paw question so that it didn't come back on me. Yeah.
Well, you know, going back to the Simpsons episode with the monkey's paw, you know, you have that wonderful segment where Maggie gets a hold of it and I think is the only person who uses it. And it's, in a way, it's like she's a child, so she makes a pure wish, you know, for just a new pacifier, which is immediately brought to her, and it doesn't seem like there's any kind of comeuppance or any dark, dark ramifications that come from having made that wish of the paw, unlike all the other monkey paw wishes.
Well, I think it's interesting that in the monkey's paw, it is a technical reading of the words of the wish that come back to bite you. But in many of these stories about the deal with the devil, such as in The Devil and Homer Simpson, it is a technical reading of the language of the agreement that actually gets you out of trouble.
Mm.
You know, trading on a loophole to escape punishment. These seem to come from the anxieties of like a literate and legalistic culture.
Yeah, the idea of the law itself as this domain with enough ambiguity in it that a skilled lawyer or sorcerer, you know, they're basically the same thing, depending on how you look at it.
Yes.
Will be able to, you know, pry you out of it.
Arcane books containing formulations of language that have the power to make things happen in the world that you can't understand. The lawyer is very much a sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to talk about the psychology of selling your soul, and I was trying to find some good psychology studies about people selling their souls. I didn't really turn up a lot that are directly on target, but some that are sort of on point but not as robust as I'd hoped, and then other things that sort of glance off of it in interesting ways. So the first thing I found was an anecdote in a 2012 book called The Righteous Mind by the American social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. And this book is about the psychological foundations of moral values and how these values feed into big systems like social groups and politics and stuff. And the story in the book about selling souls comes up in the middle of a passage about a phenomenon that Haidt calls moral dumbfounding. And this is something that you've probably encountered before. You've seen other people do it. You've done it yourself. It's where somebody makes a very strong moral judgment about something. You say, you know, that's just wrong. And then if you are asked to explain why it's wrong, you get the mental blue screen of death. You just search around frustrated for an explanation, a reason behind your moral pronouncement. Maybe you'll end up saying something, but it doesn't make a lot of sense, or you just can't think of anything at all, and yet you remain convinced of your original opinion. From another context, it's phrased as a dogmatic insistence on a moral judgment for which no good reasons can be given. And so there are all kinds of examples of this that are offered. A lot of them are read to people as very distasteful for obvious reasons. One is, would it be wrong to dip a sterilized cockroach into somebody's drink? So if I just got a cockroach and I put it through an autoclave, so I know it's absolutely sterile, could not possibly make you sick, would it be wrong for me to dip that cockroach in a glass of water and then give you the glass of water to drink and not tell you?
Yes, that would be wrong.
I feel like that would be wrong too, but it's hard to explain to come up with an explanation for the reason that would be wrong. It's like, well, it can't possibly hurt them, but it just feels really wrong. It feels like a betrayal.
Yeah, it is. I see what you're getting at. It is tricky to try and like make an argument. Like you end up having to sort of go further out on a ledge than you think you're going to. You know, you have to say things like, "Well, if you would do that, like, what else are you doing to my drink? What else does this say about our relationship that you would do this?"
And I'm not necessarily saying that you couldn't give a good reason, but it's like for a lot of people, it would be difficult to express one. And I want to come back to the difference mm-hmm. there in a bit.
Would be a health code violation.
Yes.
Regardless.
Well, I don't know. Would it be if it was sterilized? It seems like you'd need special language in the health code to address that.
Maybe we'll hear from health inspectors out there who listen to the show, but I'm guessing you can't get by sterilizing your cockroaches before exposing them. But then again, I don't know. You know, as we get more into the consumption of insects, are there food grade cockroaches you could use? I don't know.
But how would that be any different than just being sterilized? Like it seems like the implication, at least, is that questions like this play on just sort of like ick based intuitions we have about what's acceptable and what's not, that we find hard to give justifications for based on things like utilitarian concerns about harm. Instead, it's just these things about like that just feels wrong.
I guess I'm going to come back and say I would be okay with you doing this thing with the cockroach, provided it was like a food grade cockroach, which I don't think actually exists. But if it were another food grade insect, then possibly. But then again, I don't think it's a vegetarian drink anymore if you've put a dead bug in it intentionally.
All very good concerns. So I want to explain my thinking about this in a bit. But first, I just want to talk about the experiments. So Haidt in this section is discussing evidence that our moral decisions are generally not actually rational. So he's sort of making the case that when we make moral judgments, most of the time we're not reasoning to arrive at them. Instead, they're deontological intuitions. We just feel our moral decisions first, and then afterwards we use our rational minds to kind of come up with post hoc justifications for why we felt the way we did. And so some evidence of this he discusses would include the claim that adding cognitive load does not change people's moral judgments. So if you give people mental work to do while they're making moral judgments, their moral judgments don't appear to change. Or giving people more time to think about their answers to moral questions doesn't really seem to change them. And in the example of selling souls, Haidt is talking about a scenario where a graduate student of his was offering students $2 if they would sign a piece of paper that said, "I hereby sell my soul after my death for the sum of $2. And then there was also fine print that said, "This form is part of a psychology experiment. It is not a legal document and not binding in any way." And the students were told that if they signed the document, they were free to rip it up and consider it void the moment after they signed it, and they would still get their $2. And majorities of students refused, even many students who explicitly said they were atheists and didn't believe in souls. They still didn't want to do it. And so the point here is that there's something about there's something that we're using to make decisions apart from just reasoning about who it would harm. At least that's the case they're making.
$2 does seem like lowballing. Mm-hmm. In this scenario, I think I would turn it down.
Yeah, I think I would too.
Part of it's probably growing up, attending a church where the reality of demons is kind of part of the background, and then absorbing all of this this fantasy as well. Probably even seeing Treehouse of Horror as a kid, you end up having all this in your background, and it kind of creates a sense of wrongness to engage in this, or at least there's a risk factor there that should not be trifled with for a mere $2.
Well, that's so on one hand, yeah, you could argue, well, maybe this is just some sort of deontological hangover from previous beliefs you would have. But to come back on things, I think there are arguments against the post hoc rationalization theory of moral dumbfounding. Like the fact that somebody can't articulate good reasons why something should be wrong doesn't necessarily mean that there are not, in fact, good reasons. It's possible that a lot of our moral reasoning might actually be reasoning and not just deontic dogma, but it's reasoning on a subconscious level that we find hard to put into words. There are all kinds of things that people do for good reasons that you could explain in theory, but people can't figure out the right way to put it into words. So one example of this would be, on utilitarian grounds, why can't a hospital just say, like, murder one innocent patient who's there for a yearly physical and then harvest their healthy organs to save the lives of, like, you know, 10 other people who urgently need organ transplants? I feel like if you think that that kind of statement is a defeater for utilitarian reasoning, that represents a sort of shallow interpretation of utilitarianism. Like, imagine if something like that were to actually happen, the consequences of it would be that it would totally undermine the stability of the society and of medicine in a way that would make everyone paranoid and unable to trust doctors or feel safe. So the consequences of something like that actually happening in reality would be hugely destructive in a utilitarian sense, even though in the moment you have saved a number of lives. And so I think there could be similar things going on with these examples about, like, say, a contract to get $2 for selling your soul. I feel like I have a kind of idiosyncratic view on this, probably with regards to selling souls, because I would say, you know, personally, I'm kind of a provisional materialist. Like, I believe that the mind is dependent on the functioning of the physical brain. I don't see any evidence for the existence of an immaterial soul or mind that exists without the body. And yet, at the same time, I think the soul is kind of a meaningful and even indispensable concept. And I think it really means something to sell your soul, not in a supernatural sense, but in the sense that there are things we can do that represent a surrender of rights and claims to the deepest part of our own integrity. And in English, the word soul still captures that thing, that deep part of our integrity, probably better than any other word does, even though it does come with a lot of supernatural baggage. And thus, I think signing a piece of paper in agreement to sell your soul could be a thing you would want to resist doing, even though you don't believe in a supernatural soul. Like, on the physicalist or naturalist view of the world, the brain operates strongly on the basis of habit. And doing something one time always prepares you to do a similar thing more easily in the future. And so I think I would worry that selling my soul, even in a purely symbolic sense, would kind of wound my self-image in a way that would perhaps make me less protective of my integrity in the future.
I feel like, to come back to anchoring, it's also insulting to offer $2 for someone's soul, because even though you're going to turn them down, like, you've already established that that is where you're going to begin the bidding.
Yes.
So even if I come back and I'm going to, you know, say something like, well, at least offer me $100, like, that still doesn't say, I still probably wouldn't do it for $100, but now I'm already thinking about it because you started at $2.
I think you were actually very much onto something about that number there. There's a way in which the $2 makes it even worse because, again, even if you don't believe in any sort of supernatural immaterial soul, the deal would represent a kind of symbolic lowball valuing of yourself. You're just saying, like, I'm not worth very much. And that hurts you to say, even in a symbolic way where you can tear up the contract afterwards.
Yeah.
Then to come back on the other side, though, I did find a study that seemed at least on its surface value to sort of line up with the idea of valuing souls and things like that at a dogmatic or deontological level rather than a moral reasoning level. And this was an fMRI cognition study, which, of course, we've learned to always be somewhat careful about, not rely too much on just one or two studies like this about a subject, but look for some corroboration. But this study was in Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B Biological Sciences in 2012 by Gregory S. Burns, Emily Bell, C. Monica Capra, Michael J. Priecula, Sarah Moore, Brittany Anderson, Jeremy Ginjace, and Scott A. Tran. And the short version of this is that the authors of the study put people in fMRI machines and then offered them sums of money that would actually be paid out. So people would get real money in exchange for symbolically making statements that were about sort of sacred type values, deeply held personal values, but making statements that disagreed with their actual positions. And people were very resistant to doing this in some cases for understandable reasons. I think a lot of them along the lines of things we've just been talking about. And they found that, quote, using fMRI, we found that values that people refused to sell, sacred values, were associated with increased activity in the left temporoparietal junction and ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, regions previously associated with semantic rule retrieval. This suggests that sacred values affect behavior through retrieval and processing of deontic rules and not through a utilitarian evaluation of costs and benefits. So I think this finding, to the extent that it's valid, would tend to line up more with the idea that when ideas about a sacred substance are concerned, the idea of like surrendering something that is a deeply held value to yourself, you're more likely to just use the part of your brain where you intuitively automatically check the rules in your knowledge versus the part of your brain that you use to sort of think through the pros and cons of things. But anyway, I guess to wrap up this section, would you sell your soul for a donut? No. What would you sell your soul for? What kind of pastry would it have to be?
It has to be a pastry, then?
Well, I mean, what about a really good Queen of Mom?
if my soul's being sold either way, like it's a must-sell situation and I have to pick a pastry, I mean, I'm going to go with something big. Like I'm going to go with like a big moon cake, one that's about the size of a dinner table or something, you know, some sort of record-setting pastry.
Oh, what about one of those like Guinness Book parking lot-sized pizzas? How about that?
No, nothing that big. Anytime there's a food that looks like you had to use like shovels or buckets to bake it or prepare it, I'm not
really
into it.
Really fills you with confidence.
Yeah, the food needs to have been made with actual culinary instruments and tools and not things from the hardware store.
Now, is that a conclusion that you reasoned your way to, or is that a deontological judgment? I'd say the latter, but I'd agree with you.
I think it's based on watching videos of some of these record-setting baking or cooking projects, you know?
And look really dirty.
Yeah, I get being turned off by the idea of somebody using something that even if it's pristine and it's been sterilized, like you're not supposed to use a shovel to stir a chili, you know, that sort of thing.
This is really funny. This comes exactly back to the cockroach thing. So would you dip a sterilized cockroach in your apple juice and drink it? You know, no, you'd feel like that's icky somehow, even though it's sterilized. I've worked in restaurants before, and there are moments in a restaurant, because you have to create huge portions of things, that you'll be mixing up a sauce or a soup or something in buckets or even in a garbage can or something like that. And it's just like, no, you can't feed that to people. It is clean. They clean it, but it just doesn't seem right.
I agree. I would prefer not to know about that with my favorite restaurants.
Don't go in the kitchen then.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe? Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
And we're back.
All right. Well, that selection was definitely infernal. But I think in a way, our next selection is also pretty infernal. So, you know, generally speaking with horror anthology films, you have kind of a smorgasbord of horror that's presented. In some cases, the filmmakers clearly just cobbled together some short horror films with a shaky framing narrative or a creepy host. Otherwise, the theme might be the author themselves. It might be, okay, these are three stories from Stephen King, or these are three stories from Richard Matheson. Other times, it's more of a cultural or regional theme, such as, say, the film Three Extremes, which features East Asian horror tales. And then there is The Uncanny from 1977, which is, I feel like it's pretty singular. I think it might be one of a kind because it's certainly unlike any other horror anthology film that I've watched or am aware of, because the framing narrative and all three segments are devoted entirely to murderous house cats.
It's true. And I watched the whole thing.
Yeah, it is 88 minutes of feline cinematic terror. It's wall-to-wall cat sounds, cat-based jump scares, creepy music combined with cat close-ups, and some otherwise very talented actors reacting to cat scares, and of course, cats jumping out and slashing the bejesus out of people. A lot of times with real cats that are clear. I mean, there are a lot of cats in this film. Mm-hmm. Probably more cats in scenes in this film than I've ever seen in a movie before.
Though I would say also lots of cats in close-up, and I think these close-ups were filmed separately than the rest of the movie. So they just got lots of close-ups of cats meowing, hissing, swatting at things, and then cut those in with the drama that was going on, which did still involve some cats, which I'm sure was a nightmare.
Yeah, this production was clearly a nightmare. The result is I will say it's very watchable. It's a film in the tradition of the Amicus Productions. It has Peter Cushing in it. It has Donald Pleasant, some other actors of note. It's very well made. And it's interesting. I'd forgotten about this film, and then when I was researching it and kind of rediscovered it, I realized that I had in fact seen the first segment. And the first segment is the one that I rewatched for this episode. I think I caught it on A&E back when I was a kid or when I was in junior high. And I remember being creeped out at the time, and it is still effectively creepy. It is essentially an animal's attack film.
Yes, but with cats. It's Jaws with cats.
Yeah, it's the birds, but instead cats.
Oh, the birds is a better comparison because there's not just one cat. There are many, many cats.
By the way, this came out in 1977, again. That is the same year that Stephen King published a short story about a killer cat. The Cat from Hell came out in the magazine Cavalier. And this would later be adapted into the excellent horror anthology film Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, with Buster Poindexter and William Hickey. It's terrible, but good.
I really want to spoil the ending of that segment, but I won't.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Actually, Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, is definitely worth checking out. Not so much for this one, for The Cat from Hell, but it has a wonderful gargoyle story that I think I've mentioned before that is essentially a retelling of a Japanese ghost story about the Frost Maiden.
Yes, the first segment, I believe, is the mummy one that's just star-studded. It's got lots
that
of well-known
great.
Actors in it. It doesn't have, like, Christian Slater and Steve Buscemi and people.
Christian Slater's definitely in it. That mummy tale, very loosely based on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's work, is pretty terrific in that I find that it'd be one of the few, certainly, yeah, really one of the few mummy tales where they do a good job of making the mummy scary.
Yeah.
As I recall, like the mummy at one point, like it stalks up on somebody and removes their brain through their nostril with like a coat hanger, which I thought was a nice touch, you know, alluding to the practices of mummification that the ancient Egyptians employed.
Yeah. One of my other favorite mummy movies actually is the one that I've got the poster of right next to me right now, La Malédiction de Pharaon, the 1959 British mummy. I think it's Hammer. If it's not Hammer, it's very Hammer adjacent via the cast. It's got Peter Cushing. It's got Christopher Lee. It's fantastic.
All right. Well, speaking of Peter Cushing, let me go ahead and roll out the framing narrative for the uncanny.
Okay.
Peter Cushing, who again is always a class act, always elevates anything he's a part of. In this, he plays a nervous author named Wilbur Gray, who has a new manuscript about cats, about how they're actually evil supernatural creatures. They're the devil in disguise. They're out to get us. And Cushing plays this very well, convincingly coming off as extremely jumpy and sleep deprived due to the lingering threat of feline assassination. He has all the air and seriousness of a character in a spy movie, you know, who's like a defector pursued by shadowy figures through the streets. Though instead of it being like weird looking agents in trench coats, it's cats. It's stray cats. Yes. And house cats that are stalking him at every turn.
It's what are the 39 steps? And they're all cats.
Yeah.
But I will say this movie makes one grievous error with respect to Peter Cushing, which is that he has a scraggly beard in it. And Peter Cushing should always be clean shaven. He does not need facial hair. Having facial hair on Peter Cushing is like having Michael Myers wield a knife, but it's in a sheath. It's just, you know, it doesn't really capture what you're using Peter Cushing for.
Yeah. So
those face angles, they should be naked.
So that's the basic setup. He comes to his publisher's house or apartment to talk about this manuscript. And of course, the publisher has a cat, which is creeping him out even more. And he proceeds to talk about three different cases that are discussed in his book. Each one is a segment about murderous cats. The only one that I rewatched for this episode is the first one, which is terrific. It takes place in London in 1912. And in this one, we have a wealthy old woman who decides to leave her estate to her many pet cats, who are sadly mistreated by the maid. Turns out the maid is in league with the old woman's nephew, who's kind of a scoundrel and squandering his money. He's a bad dude. And he was set to inherit everything before this new will is put in place. Well, the maid catches wind of this new plan. She hears the old woman talking to her attorney about it. So she tells the nephew, and the nephew tasks her then with stealing the new will, because it's assumed that the old lady's not going to live that long. If we can just get this new will out of the picture, then, you know, the nephew will get all the money, everything will be fine, and they'll, like, run off into the sunset together, right? So what does she do? She decides to steal the will. So what she does is she sneaks into the old woman's room at night, goes to the safe, opens it up, gets the will out. But then the old woman awakens and surrounded by her many cats, accuses the maid. Well, the maid says, well, I've got to go with plan B now. And she smothers the old woman there in front of her many cats. And the cats are immediately upset. You know, they realize, whoa, you've overstepped your boundaries. You've killed this old woman. And when the maid goes to pick up the last will and testament on the floor, a cat paw comes out and scratches her hand, and she shrieks and draws back, and she's bleeding at the hand. She reaches out for it again. Cat wipes her hand again. and it's great because it's clearly like a puppet of a cat's hand scratching her cat's paw. And from there, it just becomes a full blown assault. You know, cats are leaping out at her. They're assaulting her. They're chasing her around the house. She ends up barricading herself in the larder. And for some reason, like, she's in there long enough that she's forced to eat what I think is supposed to be cat food on bread in order to survive.
Yeah, there are just jars and jars, these earthenware jars of wet cat food covered with like cloth and twine.
Yeah. Which is it's ridiculous because, like, why are you spreading that on the biscuit? Just eat the biscuits. If you're starving because you're barricaded in a room by cats, like, just eat all the biscuits up first, and then you can think of, like, she's playing a weird long game, forcing herself to eat cat food.
Yes. Yeah, there's a bread box. She, like, gets out the bread box, and it's funny because when she gets it out, you think she's going to do something with the bread box, like climb up on it to get out the window or something, but no, she just gets bread out and then spreads cat food on it.
Now, so she hangs out in there for a while, presumably like days, I don't know. Finally, she's listening at the door. Seems like things have calmed down, so she creeps out with a knife, goes back up the stairs, and tries once more to grab the will. But the cats disarm her. She runs away. I think she falls down the stairs. But before she does, she sees that the cats have, of course, begun to eat the old woman who is dead in the bed. Finally, the police break down the door. The lawyer and the nephew show up. They're, you know, horrified when they find the body of the maid. But the nephew, he's only got one thing on his mind. So he runs upstairs, goes into the bedroom where the old woman has been munched down by the cats. And he sees the will on the floor. He goes to get it. Cat jumps onto his neck, rips his jugular open, and he dies.
We also find that once they go up there, they discover the cats have also eaten the whole maid. They've just stripped her flesh like piranhas. Yes. And it apparently has happened in a matter of seconds.
Yeah. So it's ridiculous, but it's terrific. You know, these cats are not only are they sinister and murderous, but they also understand that they have a legal claim to this house and the woman's estate, and they are willing to murder to protect it.
Yeah, that's something I wasn't sure about. It does suggest that the cats understand the legal ramifications of what's going on.
Yes.
And I guess this ties in with the framing narrative, which is Peter Cushing's idea that cats secretly understand everything and run the world and that they're listening.
Now, you watch the other segments. Are they stand out at all? I felt like I'd had enough. You know, my eyes would be bigger than my stomach if I kept going.
I mean, I'd say the movie is very front loaded on the cats because the first segment is just cats, 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 and the next two segments are about cats, but they're not constantly tons of cats hissing and screeching and meowing. There's a little bit more with the human characters. The second segment has Charles Bronson's daughter in it, and she plays like a girl who gets taken into a new home and is mistreated by the daughter who already lives there and she's very mean. She's like the mean daughter in Jack Frost, and the mean daughter eventually gets punished by Charles Bronson's daughter when she does a satanic ritual that like shrinks the mean girl down to the size of a mouse and then is tormented by the cat. But ultimately, she gets stepped on by a human, not by a cat. And then that segment also has a scene where the mean daughter is tormenting the main character with a remote control airplane. But while she's like supposedly controlling the airplane, you can actually see part of the airplane just poking into the frame. So it's just sitting right there in front of her. The third segment has Donald Pleasance, and I think I was texting you about this, and my phone auto-corrected his name to Donald Pleasure, which is about right, because he is a pleasure in this segment. He's wearing a red wig, so he's Ginger Donald Pleasance, and he plays this vain actor who murders his wife to try to get a beautiful, younger, new wife, and he tries to – he's hostile toward his dead wife's cat, but the cat gets revenge on him.
Nice. I believe there's an Iron Maiden in this one, right?
Yes. There is an Iron Maiden, and it's a prop Iron Maiden for use on a film set, but it turns out the spikes are actually metal and sharp, so that when he gets closed inside it, or when somebody gets closed inside it, it impales them.
Well, you know, if you're a method actor, you, this is how you have to work.
Yeah, there's a really good scene in the third segment where Donald Pleasance is demonstrating to a bad actress how to scream. People should just clip out that scene.
Now, I want to include a word of warning about this film. So this is very much an animals attack film from 1977.
Yeah.
Now, some of you might have more experience than others with animal attacks films, but certainly the older animal attacks film, you're going to run into some questions about animal handling. Mm-hmm. And you certainly get that vibe with this production, especially in that first segment, which, again, just has so many cats. It must have just been a nightmare to film, because I remember reading about the Coen brothers making Inside Llewyn Davis and about just how much trouble they had shooting one cat and getting one cat to do what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And in this segment, the 1912 segment, they're just cats everywhere. It's just awful to imagine. And I couldn't find anything concrete about cat mistreatment on the film, but IMDb has a bit in the trivia claiming that cinematographer Harry Waxman threatened to quit when he found that the production was mistreating the cats, but it's not cited, so I don't know where he was saying that. I mean, I'm not particularly doubting it. I just don't have any evidence to back that up.
Well, I got to say, I don't know if that claim is true. And even if it is true, I thought it was phrased in an ambiguous way. So I didn't know if that meant his objection was to the production actually mistreating cats or to the fact that the movie was about the mistreatment of cats.
Right. But certainly just so many cats being used, it does raise a red flag, because if you know cats, cats in general do not want to be a part of your stupid movie project.
No.
They aren't even interested in watching your stupid movies unless you have some good high-def bird or rodent action. Mm-hmm. You know, about the most that they'll do is they'll tolerate setting on you during a film if you don't laugh too much. So I would say if you're sensitive to this sort of thing, just skip this one all the way. Plus, on top of all this, the fiction of the film involves conflict between humans and house cats. You know, it's going to deal with the idea of like your fur babies as vicious murderers and something that you would have to combat.
Well, on the other side, though, I would say that the cats in essentially all three segments are, to the extent that there is a protagonist, the cats are the protagonists, and the human character, it's like Tales from the Crypt. The human protagonists are bad people who are getting punished for their antagonism toward cats, and the cats win.
Yeah, I feel like this is kind of a golden rule of evil cat horror fiction, right? The cats need to win.
Yeah.
Like the cats.
Cat never loses.
I mean, that's the case with the Cat from Hell. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll have to have some listeners chime in on this one. Think if they can think of any examples where the evil cat doesn't win.
I cannot think of one. I mean, it seems like a very ancient meme. The cat came back. The cat's just always going to win.
All right. So I think we've established what this film is and what it's all about. It's time to start thinking deeply about it.
Okay.
So the first question that I think arises from all of this, especially that first segment in which, again, cats clearly just straight up murder two people. Mm-hmm. Has a house cat ever killed a human? And then I think this is a pretty interesting question to look into. And there have been a couple of articles, at least, that have examined it. Mike Pearl did a solid article for Vice about 5 years ago on this topic, talking to some experts about not just the historical matters here, but also just the physical attack capabilities of cats and their jaws and their teeth. The consensus seems to be that, okay, there are a few situations where cats have been linked to human deaths. For example, there are reports of cats accidentally smothering babies by laying on them, and this seems to have given rise to the, you know, the longstanding superstition that cats suck out a child's breath when they sleep. This, of course, was also part of the plot for Stephen King's Cat's Eye.
Oh, yeah, but of course the twist there is that the cat is said to be the one sucking out her life essence, but really it's a troll, and the cat is the bodyguard protecting her from the troll.
Right. So that's one area where you can say, okay, this is an example where house cats have been linked to human deaths. Some people have also died from infections caused by cats, such as rabies, but no human in all of recorded history has ever been, like, straight up attacked and killed by a house cat. Doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but it doesn't seem to have happened in a way that has been recorded and has been made notable. It basically comes back to the fact that cats, even a large house cat, simply doesn't have the bite strength to pull this off, unlike something like a domestic dog, which definitely does. I mean, even in the United States, dogs kill 30 to 50 people a year. Now, Brian Palmer also wrote an article about this for Slate, and he kicked off the article by pointing out that in 2013, an Illinois man allegedly plotted to murder an attorney and frame the victim's cat for the murder.
Whoa.
So not an example of cats actually murdering somebody, but somebody thinking they could use that to cover their own tracks.
That sounds very much like a segment that would be in The Uncanny.
Yeah. Now, Palmer points out that there have been cases where a human has reportedly had a scrape with a cat, gotten into a fight with a cat, essentially, and have to have some degree of medical intervention. In 2010, a postpartum cat in Idaho bit her owner 35 times. There was a 2011 case where a Cleveland man had to be airlifted following a house cat attack. Couldn't find a lot of details about either of those cases, by the way. So some questions remain. But, you know, really, these two accounts don't give us much to go on. For a variety of reasons, house cats may engage in play aggressive behavior or even more legitimate aggressive behavior. They may act out in defense. There is a threshold to how much of your nonsense that a cat is going to put up with. A cat may scratch you, and a cat scratch is nothing to sneeze at, certainly.
But almost certainly not going to be lethal.
Right. It seems like the main area where you see enhanced danger from cats, from house cats, is the area of a cat getting underfoot.
Mm.
Such as when you're carrying in groceries, or you're doing something in the kitchen. I think about this a lot. Like,
yep,
my cat is going to be the death of me because she's under my feet when I'm trying to move like a boiling spaghetti around the kitchen or something.
Yes. And dogs can do this too. In fact, sometimes I notice there's like an ironic attraction. It seems like dogs and cats often want to get under your feet right when you're doing something precarious, probably because it like looks unusual if you've got like a big package in your arms or something.
Yeah. Or with the cat, it's like, it's happening in the kitchen. It might be food for me. Mm-hmm. So I looked at this up a little bit, and I found a 2009 report from the CDC that said that pet-related falls involving both dogs and cats injure more than 86,000 people annually. Now, this entails a number of pet activities, ranging from taking a dog on a walk to stepping over a cat. It also involves like chasing or running from animals. So there's a lot that is entailed there. This particular write-up says, quote, most falls involving cats occurred at home, 85.7%. Approximately 11.7% of injuries occurred while persons were chasing cats. However, an activity was not specified in 62.1% of cases. The most frequent circumstances were falling or tripping over a cat. 29.2% involved other or unknown circumstances.
Now, how many of those cases where the cat caused a fall were due to someone trying to frame a cat for murder?
I don't know, half.
Yeah.
So the next question I have, of course, are cats supernatural? Are they actually the spawn of Satan? Obviously, house cats are not the spawn of Satan. They're not magical. But of course, they have been long associated with magical and or diabolical ideas. And a lot of this seems to come from several different qualities that we observe in cats. So for starters, cats haven't been domesticated as long as dogs and are by some estimates self-domesticating. So there's this idea that the cat retains a certain amount of power over itself that we might find suspicious or intimidating at times. Mm-hmm. Cats are obviously stealthy and move around in ways that we might have a difficulty, detecting them. And they may play at hunting you, especially, a house cat may do this. But I've seen outdoor cats engage in this kind of behavior as well, which can be maybe a trifle unnerving. Mm-hmm. Cats are also frequently active at night. And their eyes have a reflective layer called the tapetum lucidum that magnifies incoming light and is the reason you'll see this reflective, sometimes greenish glint to their eyes at night. And it can certainly have a kind of fairy fire look to it.
Yeah. They've got the same thing that, like, spiders have.
Yeah. And I think other things just to keep in mind is that, of course, cats are just really weird. They're kind of paranoid because they're in this weird space between prey and predator. And I feel like they're just harder to read sometimes. I feel like you can kind of get to know a dog pretty well, but cats pose more mystery.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it's just personality differences in the species. Dogs tend to be much more social. They're the kind of personality that if they were a human, you'd describe as a person who's an open book. They're very outward about their emotions and all that. Cats read to humans as aloof, reserved, kind of playing defense.
So we've read a lot into that over the years. And it should come as no surprise that you see cats featuring into various cultures and religions. We can identify a wide variety of attitudes and superstitions towards cats, and they range from divine qualities as identified by the ancient Egyptians, to just admirable qualities as identified by the prophet Muhammad. He was said to have a loyal cat named Musa, and there were various traditions and legends that were swapped around associated with Musa. I recommend researching that. It's pretty interesting. In India, as described in Nanditha Krishna's excellent Sacred Animals of India, the domestic cat is the vehicle of Shashti, a fertility goddess popular in parts of India. So you'll look at iconography of this particular goddess, and you'll see that they're clearly riding, kind of standing on a house cat.
Interesting.
However, Krishna also writes that in parts of India, a cat crossing one's path is still considered inauspicious, though. So there's still a certain amount of negative superstition wound up in cultural attitudes towards cats as well.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are a host of just superstitious cruelties involving cats. In the Golden Bough, James Frazier wrote of French shepherd traditions that involve burning or roasting cats alive in a bonfire as a way to protect the flock against sickness and witchcraft.
Yeah, that just seems to obviously tie into the historical association between cats and witchcraft. Cats often seen as the familiars of witches, the familiar spirits.
Yeah, either they're working with the witches or they are themselves transformed witches. Mm-hmm. And so you see this in Druidic customs that survive throughout Europe. Though he points out that other animals, such as snakes and foxes, suffered the same fate due to the same associations with alleged witches.
Yeah. The cats are not witches, folks. They're keeping your basement rat-free. Come on. What more could you want?
If you're gonna err, I would say err on the side of believing your cat to be a tiny god, because they certainly believe they're tiny gods. There's no excuse for cruelty to cats, be it your cat or somebody else's cat, be it a domestic, purely domestic house cat or a feral cat. Now, the next question, I guess kind of the final question that the uncanny makes me ponder is this. Are cats vengeful? Because these are all tales of, like, cats enacting revenge, cats leading to the comeuppance for villainous humans. And it's really one that's interesting to think about, because you actually hear about this a lot. If you know people with cats, if you yourself have cats, stories of cats allegedly lashing out against their humans or a particular human, perhaps peeing on something that they value or slashing something up in retaliation to something they don't like.
Mm-hmm. I've seen behavior in cats that I've never seen in dogs, like a cat being angry at being bothered or something, and then not just reacting with the sort of defensive scratch, but like chasing you afterwards to hiss and scratch.
Yeah. Again, cats are weird.
Yeah.
We have to keep that in mind. I think a lot of this goes without saying, you know, that obviously when humans have pets, we anthropomorphize them. We anthropomorphize our dogs and our cats and any other animals we might have around the house. And in doing so, it's easy to forget that they are different beings, you know, that they live in a different sense world. They're, you know, they don't just have a small human brain inside that skull of theirs. And we've put them in strange conditions that they didn't really fully evolve to inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we can't think of them as just completely, you know, unemotional beings. I mean, so the question becomes one of this. So if a cat is capable of emotional states, is it capable of seeking revenge? Is it capable of being vengeful or spiteful?
I mean, I think of revenge as an evolved adaptation that's special in social groups, when like you mm-hmm. expect to be interacting with the same individuals again and again over time, and you need to behave in a way that punishes them for behaviors across time, not just like discourages something in the moment, but like continues to enforce the kind of behavior you want from others even after the behavior has stopped.
Yeah, so we're already in a strange position because we, as very social mammals, are trying to apply the same like social structure and behavioralism on creatures that are far more solitary than we are.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking around for any, you know, feedback on this, for any insight on this, and I ran across the cat coach, Marilyn Krieger, who is a certified cat behavior consultant with the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, and they've written about this before. And I was looking at a particular article on catster.com, and they pointed out, quote, "Cats always have legitimate reasons for their behaviors. Holding grudges and deliberately being irritating are not among them."
I guess it would depend on your definitions, though I would be skeptical of anyone saying that any organism always has legitimate reasons for its behaviors. I mean, sometimes behaviors just kind of happen.
Well, I mean, it makes you ask a lot of questions about revenge. Is there legitimate revenge?
Yeah.
Like if it happens in a Shakespeare play, is that like that's legitimate? Or it happens in a TV drama, it's legitimate?
Uh-huh.
Whereas real life revenge is rarely that simple. I mean, you know, it gets pretty muddy pretty quickly.
I guess maybe the point here, which would seem pretty reasonable to me, is that it seems like a cat's time horizon for reacting to behavior is probably going to be a lot shorter and probably going to be a lot more just like basically situationally utilitarian than would be justified by a Wrath of Khan style revenge plot.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's the big question. Are cats capable of plotting revenge?
Yeah.
I think there's a strong case to say no. However, will a cat scratch you, bite you, or hiss at you because you did something that they did not like, as an immediate response? I think the answer there, obviously, yes.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't believe me, you know, think about the last time you tried to touch your cat's belly and they weren't into it.
Mm-hmm.
They probably let you know. You know, cats will generally be very, if not vocal, then at least active about their preferences regarding their belly fur.
I remember cats I've known being very sensitive about their paws, like you don't want to touch the paws.
Yeah, those are their murder weapons. Don't disrespect them.
Right. It's like, you cannot touch my sword.
Yeah. Unless it draws your blood.
The warrior sword is sacred.
So for a cat, Krieger points out, what frequently happens is that a cat does something in response to change in their immediate environment, and they're highly susceptible to change in their environment. A change in the household can induce stress and anxiety in the cat, and this can lead to medical problems, like actual, like legitimate medical problems, such as urinary tract problems, bladder problems, etc., that may cause them to do things that can then be interpreted as acting out. Even things like so-called spite peeing, where they're peeing on, say, your favorite pillow or something. It might be tied to a medical issue, like some sort of bladder flare-up, or it could be tied more to like a separation anxiety, which may cause them to urinate on their favorite person's stuff in order to mingle their scent with that of the owner. So, again, like that's the kind of thing where that's outside of the human, our human emotional states for the most part, the idea of mingling scents to feel with someone else's scents to feel better about them being away from you. Mm-hmm. But within a cat's sense realm, that may make perfect sense. Like that is the perfect thing to do. That is the perfect comforting act.
And then on the other side of it, like there are some analogies I think people can understand pretty well. Like it might be harder to behave correctly and maintain mastery over all your bodily functions when you're very stressed.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult for us. It's going to be difficult for other organisms as well. So I think it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, the cat world is different from the human world, even if we're sharing the same house. And I mean, this applies to any animal. The dog world is different from the human world, even though you spend your lives together.
Yeah. You share the same space, but you don't see the world the same.
All right. On that note, I think we're going to go ahead and close it out here. As of October 2020, I believe you can watch, you can generally watch the Treehouse of Horror episodes on Disney Plus. I think that's where they're currently hosted for streaming. The Uncanny was a little harder for me to get a hold of. I had to subscribe to some sort of some indie channel on Amazon Prime in order to stream it. But I don't know. It's probably out on YouTube or something as well.
I found it on the tube of the second person.
Ah. But, that may change. By the time you listen to this episode, perhaps it's streaming in a more accessible place. All right. We're going to go ahead and close the door on Anthology of Horror Volume 6. And hey, if you like these, if you want this tradition to continue next October, well, you have a little less than a year to start pelting us with suggestions. What are your favorite episodes of various horror and sci-fi anthology series that you would like us to consider, or your favorite segments from anthology films? Let us know. We would love to hear from you. In the meantime, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you find your podcasts, and wherever that happens to be, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe. You can always find us by going to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That will shoot you over to our iHeart page, and if you go there, there's a listing for our store, and if you go there, you can buy a shirt with our logo or a monster on it.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.